Nathaniel Nat Barton was born at Wellington in 1894, the third son of Charles and Annie Barton. He spent most of his life growing up on their property, Nanama, close to Wellington, which his parents bought in that same year of 1894. His father, Charles, died in 1912. Nat's later education was at the King's School in Parramatta, where he became head boy and a sergeant in the cadets. He was in his first year of medical studies at Sydney University when the war broke out. While at university, he held the rank of 2nd Lieutenant with the 34th Infantry Battalion. Putting on hold his medical studies, he enlisted on November 20, 1914. He retained his rank of 2nd Lieutenant and was given a command in C Squadron, 7th Light Horse Regiment. On December 18, 1914, C Squadron and the Machine Gun Section embarked on the HMT Ajana. Nat's older brother Brian was a trooper in the 6th Light Horse Regiment. He sailed in the same convoy aboard the Suevic. The convoy arrived at Alexandria on the 1st of February 1915. As the infantry landed on Anzac Cove, the Light Horse continued to train. On May 1, Nat received his promotion to Lieutenant. By mid-May, the 7th Light Horse Regiment was sent to fight at Gallipoli, but as dismounted troops. The 7th landed on May 20 and moved into positions in Death Gully. They were involved in establishing Ryrie's Post and spent much of their time on the cove there, but they were also involved with the Lone Pine attacks. While at Anzac Cove, Nat received a slight wound to his nose, which, although requiring evacuation to Mudros, did not keep him away from his regiment for long. Nat was promoted to temporary captain on October 15. A short break to Imbros to command the General's bodyguard in late October also followed, and then Nat was back with the 7th Light Horse when they were among the last to evacuate Anzac Cove on December 19, 1915. This was a remarkable feat. Over 35,000 men left the area over 11 days without being noticed. 20,000 of those on the nights of December 18 and 19. Great lengths were taken to deceive the enemy. The men's boots were covered with bagging, blankets or old woolen socks to muffle their footsteps. There was a trail of rice laid on the routes to the beach for the men to follow in the darkness, and a number of timed guns and bombs were set to go off for 2 hours after the last group had left, some using water dripping into a tin tied to the trigger and others by slow matches. Nat wrote to his mother just a couple of days after the evacuation and gives a local's view of how things went, including his thoughts on the English troops, known as Tommies.
My dear mother, as I expect you know by now, Anzac and Suvla have been evacuated without casualty. A few guns were left behind, but they were old and of course were blown up before being deserted. Most of the stores were burned by an accidental fire a couple of nights before, a fire which we were very frightened might give the show away to the Turks, but which I think they must have thought was set alight by their own shells. The rest of the supplies were to be shelled by our boats when the enemy discovered that we were gone, which they did not do till 2 o'clock the next afternoon at any rate, as up till then they were bombarding our trenches. The evacuation itself was carried out without a hitch, but we can thank God for the weather, which was absolutely perfect for our plans. Ever since the snow and the freezing wind which followed it, we've had calm, warm days and nights, with a lovely moon approaching her full, but with very often a mist filling the atmosphere. I knew for certain what was to be done 4 days before, and was first told that I was among the last party to leave. The night following the news, I certainly felt excited and nervous, but I was all right after that till Saturday night when the first big party left. I think everyone felt the strain a bit then, just as the party was going off, and for about half an hour afterwards, after that we felt quite all right. On Sunday night, the rest of the regiment left and was divided into three parties, A, B and C. Each of these was again divided into three, leaving a quarter of an hour after one another. I was charged with the C party to B3, which left at 10 past 10. The A party left about 6, B at about 10, and C at about 2:30 next morning. Three officers and 27 men were in the last party for the regiment. The moon in the early part of that night had a perfect rainbow around it, but this afterwards disappeared. It was bright moonlight marching down and very impressive seeing parties coming from all directions in silence, with padded feet to deaden any sound, and all making for their appointed places to the tick of time. Then out at sea, the transports lay at anchor, with boats plying busily backwards and forwards to the shore, and the brilliantly lighted hospital boats in deep contrast to the others, which were without a light. You'll probably hear wild rumours of men left behind, but one case of a 13th Battalion man is true. He was a sentry in a tunnel and fell asleep. He awoke with a pain in the tummy, only too common at Anzac, and on going out found the trenches deserted. He raced for the beach and arrived without rifle or pack in time for one of the last boats. The tale he now tells himself is a very different edition and much more heroic, but I think this is right. As to the evacuation itself, I think it was a great move, since it has been done successfully, as the men suffered cruelly in the cold which we had. The Australians and New Zealanders certainly had a good many cases of frostbite, and some of my toes haven't got their circulation back yet. But it was the Tommies at Suvla who lost. I don't know the figures at all, but hundreds died, and the number ran up to thousands who were sent away owing to exposure. This was partly due to the nature of the country, and partly that there are such a lot of city men among them. I'm afraid the Australians haven't much of an opinion of a Tommy now. It's a pity, but we have seen only second-rate regiments, and the Australians seem much quicker at inventing things which are useful for trench warfare. The English fought in France 9 months before the Australians began, yet the latter were at the front a month before they invented the periscope rifle, a thing which has been invaluable to us and which the enemy has not yet been able to make successfully. They too have invented a good many other things, but the time it took to get made and send out meant we did not get the full advantage of them. We arrived in Lemnos Harbour early Monday morning, and after several changes were put on this boat and sailed Tuesday afternoon. It was rather funny, as some Tommies came on board that afternoon, and as usual their officers had tons of kit. We were all jeering at the gang of men carting up huge valises, bundles of swords, tent chairs and different things, and wondering if they would get them on in time. They didn't manage to do so, however, and the captain had the gangway hauled up, leaving a good bit of baggage and some men behind. After all, we only reached the mouth of the harbour that night owing to an accident. We just missed running into a large boat which steamed across our bows by stopping dead and pulling down our anchor. Then, when we tried to sail again, the wind caught us, owing to our having no way on, and we had to make for a channel between two rowboats at anchor. A smaller boat, however, was coming up behind, and being unable to turn aside owing to these boats, had nothing left to do but run into us. She only broke one of our lifeboats and some railings through, as well as her own bow, and after that we anchored for the night, setting forth this morning. I've forgotten to tell you that an Austrian battery of 12.4-inch guns began to fire on us on Saturday evening, and for which we had been preparing by digging funk holes. It, I believe, gave Lone Pine a great doing all Monday morning after everyone had left. Shells of that size are rather expensive too. Also, to show you how we were favoured by the weather, on Tuesday morning it blew a gale from the south, which made embarking impossible at Anzac and Suvla, so we only got off with a day to spare. Christmas morning, and we have taken the pilot on board to go to Alexandria, and are feeling very pleased that we have escaped the submarines. The sun is just rising over the city in the yellow eastern sky, which is very pretty, so I think I shall go up on deck and look at it. I must try to send a cable as soon as possible to wish you a joyful Christmas and let you know that we are back in Egypt once more. I am your affectionate son, Nat D. Barton.
Back in the Middle East, Nat was promoted to captain on March 12, 1916. As the infantry reorganised, ready for a move to the Western Front, the 7th Light Horse Regiment prepared to fight the Turks in Palestine and Sinai. He was promoted to Major in September 1916. Nat's favourite horse was Cossack. He received a shrapnel wound at one stage, but after treatment was soon back with his master. Nat's second mount, Macquarie, also served with that squadron. Macquarie came from Bougainvillea and made the trip overseas with Corporal Eric McGill, also of Bougainvillea. Corporal McGill's family was heavily involved in racehorses, and when he enlisted in the Light Horse, he purchased Macquarie from the Coombs family of Bougainvillea. But the deal was subject to a promise that the horse would never race. The Coombs family was strict Methodist and frowned on the sport. Unfortunately, young Eric McGill was wounded at Gallipoli while waiting for sick leave and died later at Malta. It was at that stage that his major, Nat Barton, acquired Macquarie and rode him until the end of the war. He then sold him to the Indian Army, and the story goes that he became a star on the Indian racetracks. There are many other references to Nat Barton and the Light Horse in Sinai and Palestine in 1917. On December 3 of that year, during an attack by the 6th Light Horse on a strategic position near Tel Aviv in Israel, which the Australians called Bald Hill, Nat's brother Brian was killed. Another Wellington lad, Billy Bassett, received a military medal for his actions as a stretcher bearer. It's believed Brian Barton was killed by friendly fire. In his letters, Nat wrote, "Our men crawled out and lay concealed between the lines and waited for the artillery to lift. Unfortunately, one of the guns dropped shells short, and these fell amongst our own men. Bryan's body was lying exposed in the field for 3 weeks. It was recovered only after the Allies advanced northwards and a Scottish infantry unit captured the area. Dr. Barton was nearby when his brother was buried and rode all day to visit his grave. He also returned at the end of the war and planted a Currajong tree which still stands today. It was visited by his son and grandsons just a couple of years ago." In January 1918, Nat's younger brother Denny arrived in the Middle East and joined the 6th Light Horse Regiment. Nat and Denny were both with their respective regiments on the 27th and 28th of March 1918 during the First Battle of Amman, in which the 6th and 7th Light Horse Regiments suffered heavy casualties. Cold, wet, boggy conditions prevailed, and after 3 nights of marching, with the enemy holding higher advantageous positions, the Anzac Mounted Division was finally ordered to retire. During that attack, Nat was struck just above the knee by a bullet. Finding he could still walk, he kept going, only to be struck again, this time in the thigh. He had to be stretchered back to the supporting field ambulance where he was initially treated. In the same battle, Denny was struck by shrapnel in his left upper arm. Casualties in the Anzac Mounted Division during the battle totaled 117 killed, 551 wounded, and 55 missing. The trip back to hospital was a slow one. The evacuation procedure took 10 days for him to reach the General Hospital at Port Said. Although his wounds healed cleanly, his leg had been badly broken, and when fit enough to travel, Nat was invalided back to Australia. By the signing of the peace armistice in November 1918, Nat was back at the family property Nanama, continuing his recovery. He proudly led a peace demonstration march through the streets of Wellington on November 13, 1918, just 2 days after the official signing of the armistice. Nat resumed his medical studies in 1919, qualifying as a doctor in 1923 and starting practice in Parkes. He mostly practiced at Wellington, where his name is still very well known today. In World War II, he became a colonel and was in charge of the North Australian and Papua New Guinea Medical Corps. During that time, he was awarded a Commander of the Order of the British Empire for his distinguished service to the war effort in New Guinea. Nat Barton died in 1985.